I'm Darin Abugaida. This is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera, your weekly look at the world of business and economics. This week, central banks take decisive action and increase interest rates to try and bring soaring consumer prices under control. We ask what more needs to be done. Also this week, we take a look at what's in store for the global aviation industry after it was plunged into a financial crisis during the pandemic. And this year's Qatar Economic Forum saw movers and shakers descend on Doha. Top of the agenda, the global economic recovery. Plus, we count the cost of protecting hundreds of thousands of homes and businesses as rising sea levels threaten communities in the UK. The cost of living keeps sliding higher, and now central banks have sprung into action. The U.S. Federal Reserve, the Bank of England, and Swiss National Bank all increased their key interest rates, and the European Central Bank has indicated it will move in a similar direction in July. Targeting inflation is the central bank's main goal, and it helps to maintain price stability, but it's not been working. We've seen protests around the world over the higher cost of food and services in the past week. A little inflation can be a good thing if everyone's salary rises at the same pace as prices, but they haven't been. So let's look at why inflation has been going up around the world recently. There are oil prices, which have slumped at the start of the pandemic, but demand has rocketed since. The war in Ukraine has affected this too. Brent crude hit an 8-year high, and of course, petrol is more expensive. The cost of everyday items has risen since 2020. Many people had more disposable income to spend on household goods during lockdowns. Firms have struggled to keep up with demand. And let's not forget the U.S.-China trade war, which drove up tariffs. There are shipping firms which have been busier because of the surge. And as a result, retailers have to pay more to get those items into the shops. That cost has been passed on to consumers. Millions quit the workforce or change jobs as a result of the pandemic. And some sectors increased wages to attract new staff. Again, that's driven up prices. Severe storms and droughts hurt harvests around the world. The war in Ukraine has seen its grain harvests and exports affected. Plus, governments have been ending support to businesses impacted by the pandemic. Subsequent tax rises have contributed to the cost of living squeeze felt by many. Well, joining us from London is David Coker, who's a senior lecturer in finance at the University of Westminster. Welcome to Al Jazeera, sir. Thanks so much for your time. So we were covering there some of the main drivers behind the rising costs of inflation. And central banks, as we've been saying, have increased key interest rates to try and keep that inflation down somewhat. What more can central banks and governments do?
Oh, Doreen, thank you so much for having me today. The central banks are really in a tough spot. Inflation globally is surging. It's not all supply side, or as we're led to believe. And the only levers they really have, at least talking about the Fed, are the balance sheet as well as interest rates. Those are the two broad levers that the Fed can pull. And they're really in a rough position, because inflation's surging, they're increasing interest rates very sharply to try to get control of it. They ideally would like to do it without causing a recession, but their track record is very poor there. And we also have to keep in mind that the consumer is getting the message. We saw consumer confidence in the States fall to a record low this month. It dropped 14% in 1 month, and it's down 41% from a year ago. So the consumer is increasingly worried because of these hawkish messages and actually actions from the Fed and central bank. So really all they can do is just bring on a recession.
Right. Let's drill down into some of the reasons why inflation is so high. I mean, we were mentioning earlier on that a part of this can be as a result of the U.S.-China trade war. Do you agree with that? How much of a driver is that issue? And if the U.S. actually removed tariffs on Chinese goods, do you think that could help in some way?
No, ma'am, I don't agree it's totally. I'd like to come back to that, but I'll talk about this point, but I don't agree it's totally because of the U.S.-China trade war.
Now, not totally because, but it could be one of the reasons, is it not?
Oh, sure, it's a contributor, but it's difficult to quantify exactly what. Before tariffs were levied, Chinese exports definitely were a major deflationary force that we enjoyed for 15 years, perhaps. Now, removing the tariffs are definitely going to lower the cost of imports into the States. That's good, but we have to keep in mind, and this is something the Western media misses sometimes, the Chinese economy has been restructuring very rapidly. And China is going to transition to what we call a high income country sometime in late 2023. In many ways, this puts China on a par with the US and other Western democracies. It's not the low income nation it was perhaps 5 years ago, heavily reliant upon export.
Okay, and what about the UK? I mean, you're speaking to us from London, and as you know, of course, the Bank of England increased their base rate for the fifth time in a row last week to 1.25%, but inflation has hit another 40-year high in May, reaching 9.1%. It's pretty astounding. How much higher do you think it could go?
Oh, I can't talk in detail about the UK, but I can look at the States. I've done a lot of research in that area. If we look at the last period of high inflation in America, one thing we have to understand is that inflation is sticky. And once it's established, it's tough to get rid of. So inflation in the States hit a high of 14.6% in March 1980. The Fed started sharply increasing interest rates to get ahead of it, to try to bring it down. They brought interest rates up to 19.1% by June 1981. And in spite of these higher interest rates, inflation didn't drop down below 3% until June 1983, or roughly 3 years from the peak of inflation. So my feeling is we're going to have to see interest rates rise above inflation, not for a long time, but rise above it. And we likely will see rates approach inflation at some point.
Do you think that the mortgage rate rises in the U.S. is something to be concerned about? And if so, why?
Oh, I should reveal this. I'm active in property. I have a property business. And I do have assets in the States as well as the UK.
Right.
I think it's a good thing what's happening. Both in the US and the UK, we've seen sharp increases in house prices. Totally stunning. And just for some perspective, in America, I took a look at the median house price and the median wage. If we express it in ratio form, we can learn a lot about the scale of the bubble. Here's some context. In Q4 2021, the median house price divided by the median wage, that ratio was 160%. Houses really, really wildly overvalued compared to wages. For context, if you look at Q1 2006, that same ratio was 141%. And we all know what happened in 2007, a huge property collapse. It's coming again, Doreen. The market's already slowing down. JP Morgan announced plans to lay off or reassign about 1,000 staff in their mortgage business. We've seen other mortgage lenders doing the same. They're doing this in response to their customer demand. It's collapsing. We're also seeing some other signs. If we look at the number of properties listed for sale, it's growing. And keep in mind that just 3 to 6 months ago, the market was so red hot, a large number of properties were sold without even being listed. These are significant changes. I welcome them because they can take some froth off the market and bring homes down to a point where the average American or even the average British worker could afford them. Right now, it's very tough.
If you can just give me your outlook, sort of the best and worst case scenario for the U.S. and Europe going forward.
Oh, boy. Well, I'm American, so I'm naturally optimistic. I'm a very optimistic person. I'll just say the best case is a short, sharp recession. The harder and deeper and the shorter, the best. Recessions eliminate excess capacity. Recessions, as we just discussed, they reduce demand. And all this would be welcome in this economy. Now, the worst case, and I really hope we don't see this, is stagflation. Now, stagflation definition is above average unemployment in a macro environment of above average inflation. Stagflation is much, much worse than even the most harsh recession. We haven't seen stagflation in the U.S. since the mid-70s to early 80s. And during that time, the misery index, and again, this is I wrote an article about this, it's defined as the sum of unemployment and inflation soared. Well, it's going to happen again, Doreen, because we're going to start to see unemployment tick up. Inflation's already fairly high. The misery index will soon be rising.
All right. I did want to end on a positive note with you, but unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. We've run out of time. David Coker, we really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Take care. Thanks again, Doreen.
The Qatar Economic Forum took place in Doha this week. Major business leaders and heads of state met to discuss a roadmap to a global economic recovery. One of the topics was the rising cost of energy. Hashem Ahelbara has more.
a deal that's taken years to finalize. Qatar Energy is teaming up with giant gas companies to expand its production of liquefied natural gas, or LNG. Their drive comes at a crucial moment for Europe as it moves towards cutting natural gas imports from Russia. And it's Qatar that is most likely to meet Europe's gas demands, an opportunity that cements the tiny Gulf nation's role as a global energy player.
If you look at what we're doing in Qatar, we started in 2017 to embark on the largest LNG expansion in the world, and we're going to be increasing our production from 77 to 126 million tons per annum by 2026, which will help greatly the requirement of gas around the world.
Russia's invasion of Ukraine has shaken energy markets. Prices are rising, and energy exporters are capitalizing on growing demands. Namibia has recently announced major oil discoveries that will double the country's GDP by 2040. But its Minister of Energy remains confident the new finds won't stop investments in renewables.
Africa as a continent probably only contribute less than 2% to the emission in any case. And for Namibia, we are now actually in a very good position. Here we are actually leveraging our resources, which is fossil fuel resources. And at the same time, we are going to produce green hydrogen that can actually help the globe to decarbonize.
Here in Doha, leaders, CEOs and economists discussed ways to combat poverty, reduce carbon emissions and maintain economic growth. But the global economic outlook seems somber. Inflation is rising, prompting governments to increase interest rates. But the path to achieving any soft landing may be longer than initially thought.
A slowdown is difficult because you lose your job. Or a slowdown is difficult because your business has less revenues, or you have less orders, or you have less activity, you have less customers. If at the same time of having less revenues for your company, your costs are also rising, that has implications for unemployment, that has implications for government revenues, the ability for governments to then reinvest back into the economies.
Food prices are also continuing to rise. Hundreds of millions of people could find themselves unable to pay for staples such as bread, meat and vegetables. 2022 is the year many hoped would end the fallout from the COVID-19 pandemic and set in motion a global economic recovery. Then came the war in Ukraine, which has led to an increase in energy prices and a shortage of grain supplies. All these factors, along with higher inflation, are likely to stall economic growth and may even lead to a prolonged recession. Hashim Harbala for Al Jazeera's Counting the Cost, Doha.
The head of global aviation body IATA says he's confident the industry will return to profitability in 2023. The global pandemic plunged the global aviation industry into its worst financial crisis in its history. Losses are estimated at more than $200 billion over 2 years. During that time, the Air Transport Action Group reports that more than 2 million jobs were cut. And now there's a scramble to hire tens of thousands of employees, but security screenings are causing delays. The shortages have led to flight cancellations, especially in Europe, despite the high numbers of people wanting to travel. And as we mentioned earlier, the war in Ukraine has seen fuel prices double, leading to a roughly 30% hike in flight prices. Kamel Al-Awadi is the vice president of IATA for the Middle East and North Africa. He thinks there are many reasons to be hopeful.
Just looking at how well the industry performed this year, the start of this year, even with a hiccup like the Omicron the end of last year, the resilience of the airline, how nimble they adjust, each airline adjusts its capacity and what it needs. You can see the numbers just grow month over month. Looking at their plans down the road, even with like the rising prices of oil and stuff like that, we're still looking very optimistic. Yes, airlines are smart enough to not put all its capacity back into the market. So there's still 20, 17% of that capacity not being used. And of course, that reduces a lot of the operational cost or the fixed cost in some cases. So they are managing their resources more carefully and achieving the profit. But don't forget, they're achieving a profit. That does not mean they're profitable. They're achieving a profit, but they have 2 years of losses to recap. I think most of the airlines, specifically in this region, calculated their manpower requirements and their resources very carefully and accurately, from what I can see. And I think the demonstration of how they restarted again, and they restarted with a bang at a faster rate than anybody expected, and yet without the problems that we're facing in Europe and in the US.
Qatar Airways CEO Akbar Al-Bakir told us his outlook is positive.
I am still optimistic that that things will continue for the foreseeable future. I also don't think the oil price will stay at this level forever. And there's a shortage of capacity because airlines cannot fly all their airplanes due to shortage of manpower, pilots. Fortunately, that is not the case with us.
We also spoke to Warwick Brady. He's the president and chief executive of Swissport, the global aviation services company. He talked us through the magnitude of some of the tests that the industry has faced.
Governments acted unilaterally in this very difficult pandemic, and they didn't coordinate or consult with the aviation industry, whether it be IATA or ICAO, so they effectively killed the aviation industry. And then to expect the aviation industry to literally restart from a very low level to back to effectively near 2019 levels is a very big challenge for everyone.
With a long and well-populated coastline, the UK is at serious risk from climate change. Flooding and storm damage could make many areas uninhabitable by 2050. The government is planning to spend $7 billion to protect the coast. But experts say hard decisions are needed about which areas are saved and which are surrendered to the sea. Jonah Hull reports from Sidmouth in Devon.
This is Sidmouth on the Devon coast, a Georgian town that's lost 100 metres of shoreline in a century, a rate that's now close to double in places. On its east beach, the cliffs have been crumbling for years. Where once there was climate denial, there is now an unavoidable reality. As we watched, another section fell into the sea.
Certainly climate change now has changed people's perception in the last couple of years. I think there's a recognition that there's a tremendous danger from climate change.
Coastal defences already in place protect the town's promenade, but they've affected the natural tidal drift, making things worse for the nearby cliffs.
Down here at the waterline, you can clearly see the forces of nature weighing on this landscape. Down one side, there's river runoff, made heavier by more frequent storm activity. Up above the cliffs, heavy rainfall that saturates the soil. From below, the waves lapping all the way pretty much up to the base of the cliffs, their own beach protections washed away. It's a three-pronged assault, making this World Heritage site and others like it all the way up and down the Jurassic coast vulnerable, fragile, prone to collapse.
The problem is people live up here, some in large houses with majestic sea views and fast receding front lawns.
It is worrying, but I assume with my age, it's not going to be a physical problem to myself. But the further down the road you get, obviously the worry will get larger.
I mean, there are gardens that are literally falling into the sea down there.
Absolutely, and at some stage, they've got to do something to protect the town.
A 2020 report by the Committee on Climate Change found that 1.2 million homes in the UK are at high risk of flooding, and 100,000 more will succumb to coastal erosion in decades to come. There's increased funding for protection, but not everywhere can receive it, and that means hard choices lie ahead.
Basically telling those people who live there that you will no longer be able to live here in the next 20, 30, 40 years. You'll have to abandon your house because we can no longer afford to protect you. Now, those are really, really tough decisions. And those sorts of decisions will increasingly be necessary in the future.
The homeowners overlooking East Beach are clinging on for now. There are plans being worked out by the local council for a protective barrier to be placed in the sea. It's a race to hold back the rising tide. Jonah Hull, Al Jazeera, Sidmouth.
Joining us from London is Swenja Sierminski, who's the Managing Director of Climate and Sustainability at the global insurance giant Marsh McLennan. She's also a member of the Independent Adaption Committee that advises the UK government on climate risks. Welcome to Al Jazeera. Talk us through the current flood risk in the UK and what impact that could have.
Yeah, hello. Thank you very much for inviting me. Flooding is the largest climate risk that the UK is facing. And we see this already in terms of the impacts on communities and businesses. But going forward, these trends are expected to increase. And that extends to flooding from coastal floods, from river floods, but also rainfall, sudden rainfall events, as we've also seen last year in London.
So what are the socioeconomic ramifications of such flooding?
Well, flood risk is already the most costly risk today. And there are estimates from the government that the economic damage to business sites will actually exceed $1 billion per year by 2050. So that gives us a taste, but there are other implications. And our research here at Marsh McLennan has also looked at where, for example, infrastructure is located and where assets are being built. And this is a really important story because we see that actually quite a large number of new homes in the UK are built in areas threatened by flooding, particularly low-income households, which are then disproportionately at risk.
Okay, here's the thing. I mean, what would your advice be on how to get countries to start to rethink their approach to flood risk, and what strategies do they need to put in place?
Well, I mean, first of all, I think we really need to be upfront and say climate change is a threat multiplier and it will amplify existing vulnerabilities. So if you look at supply chains, transport, water, food security, all these are going to be impacted by flood. So we really need to get that message out that this is actually not just a question of getting your feet wet, because you can be impacted by floods without being directly physically flooded.
Okay.
So that opens up also a lot of opportunities to then work across those supply chains, work across communities in terms of enhancing flood protection, changing particularly production processes, and ultimately also moving away from out of harm's way certain assets.
Which country, I mean, is it possible to say which country is the best prepared, and also who is the worst prepared at this point?
Well, our research says that all major industrial countries actually have a significant flood risk problem, but are also starting to invest in flood risk resilience. But it's really important that what we're trying to do here is basically playing almost catch up, because when we look at climate change, I mean, we are already experiencing climate change. So we're living already in a world with climate. And we know that even with emissions reduction, if we're achieving a 2-degree warming scenario, our estimates show that the percentages of people who are exposed to flood risk are expected to double from today's level. So that gives you a scale of the problem. And then, yeah, it's down to countries to take advanced action and to manage that.
Well, one such government or country, rather, that seems to have made some progress on this, and correct me if I'm wrong here, is the Netherlands, because it spends billions of euros every year maintaining and upgrading its defenses. Can other countries learn from the Netherlands model, like the Maldives, like the UK, like other island nations who are most at risk?
Well, certainly there is a lot that we can learn. And the Netherlands are, because of their exposure, it's a low-lying country with a coastline. They have made flood risk management part of their national strategy for a long time. The key question is, you know, at what point are we taking these measures? And you mentioned a lot of island nations. The key point there is to also increase their capacity to act and take this action now.
All right. We will leave it there. We thank you very much, Swenja Sierminski, for joining us from London. And that's our show for this week. You can get in touch with us by tweeting me at DarinAG, and do use the hashtag AJCTC when you do so. You can also drop us an email. Countingthecost at aljazeera.net is our address. But there's more for you online at aljazeera.com/CTC, and that'll take you straight to our page, which has individual reports, links, and entire episodes for you to catch up on. That's it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Darin Abugaida from the whole team. Thanks for joining us. The news on Al Jazeera is next.